Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Now, the former US President Joe Biden has been diagnosed with an aggressive form of prostate cancer that has spread to his bones. The news comes amid a series of disclosures revealing the state of Mr. Biden's physical and cognitive decline during his presidency. Mr. Biden's successor is expected to speak to the Russian President Vladimir Putin today as the killing in Ukraine continues. Let's get the latest on all of this now with from Washington by foreign correspondent Sarah Firth. We're also joined by law lecturer at the University of Galway and political columnist with the journal.ie, Larry Donnelly. But Sarah, to you first, that news about Joe Biden, it emerged last night. We were told he was diagnosed on Friday. But as of today, what more do we know about that entire situation and his cancer diagnosis?
So the statement coming from the former President Joe Biden's office was that he was diagnosed with prostate cancer, as you said, characterized by a Gleason score of 9, grade group 5, and that statement confirming that the cancer had spread to bone. Now, the statement also went on to say that the president had been given this diagnosis on the back of seeking medical help for a new finding of a nodule after increasing urinary symptoms that he'd been experiencing. The statement saying, quote, whilst this represents a more aggressive form of the disease, the cancer appears to be hormone sensitive, which allows for effective management. Now, of course, there's been an outpouring of support from both sides of the aisle. You've had President Trump and the First Lady saying that they are saddened by the news. You've had the former Vice President Kamala Harris, who served under Biden, saying that, Joe is a fighter. He will face this challenge with the same strength, resilience and optimism that has always defined his life and leadership.
Now, we also had news, though, over the weekend, or we had information on his cognitive decline. What was happening behind the scenes in the run-up to the debate he had against Donald Trump, which ultimately ended his challenge for a second stint in the White House? That news has been put to the back burner somewhat, but there was a lot, wasn't there, in terms of information that people within the Democrats and Joe Biden had in relation to how serious his decline was at that time.
Yes, I mean, following this since last year and that presidential debate in the lead up to the elections, you know, that was disastrous for then President Joe Biden. There was no question about that. There were huge questions, you know, not just among politicians, but among the general public that I was asked about speaking to at the time about, you know, what was going on. And we have had a bit more clarity now with some of the journalists who wrote this book, alleging that behind the scenes, you know, some aides were at one point even considering offering him a wheelchair. Now, there has been some pushback from members of the Democratic Party at the time who say that that wasn't quite the severity of the situation. Basically, Claire, I mean, at this point, people are left with a lot of questions. There are a lot of gaps in the narrative over what exactly happened, how hard there was questioning whether we got the full picture at the time, both journalists and the public, about exactly what happened. But look, I think the focus right now is on this latest news of this cancer diagnosis. And also, I think a lot of attention being paid to the fact, I certainly, even as a journalist, didn't realise how robust the former president had been in himself championing cancer programs. When he was under Obama in 2016, he'd led what was called the Cancer Moonshot, a government-wide research program. His own son, Beau, died of brain cancer. So, you know, there's this outpouring of sympathy, of course, a lot of focus on this sort of legacy that he's you know, built in particular when it comes to fighting cancer and the fight that he now faces himself. But, you know, undeniably, there are going to be questions about the timeline, who knew what, when.
Mm-hmm. And those questions, Larry, to bring you in at this point, persist, notwithstanding all of the goodwill that has been directed towards Joe Biden in light of his diagnosis and to his family as well. But what we were hearing over the weekend about his decline in the run-up to 2024, I mean, the consensus seems to be that his inner circle should have realised far sooner that he needed to pass the torch to a successor much sooner than he did.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was the premise of his campaign in 2020, was, without saying it, that he was going to be a one-term president, that he was going to pass the torch, as you say. But the truth of it is that Joe Biden had been running for president for decades. And once he got to the top of the mountain, it was always going to be difficult to dislodge him. And I think certainly within his inner circle, whether his wife, his son, others, I think they very much wanted him to continue on. And I think they were very misguided in that, such that Joe Biden, who has, I think, a laudable career in many respects in public service, he's also overcome a tremendous amount of adversity and tragedy, but his name will ever be affixed to the idea that he hung on too long and that in so doing, he allowed Donald Trump to become president again. And that will be a part of his legacy, sadly, from his point of view, you know, when, again, it was manifest that he wasn't up to the task. And the fact that he continued on was really remarkable and extraordinary. And I think that lots more people knew about it than were saying it at the time. And I think that they are culpable in this as well.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Jake Tapper, who's co-author of this book that has been making the headlines over the weekend, he himself saying that on the media's part, he now realizes that he and others should have pushed harder to find out the truth of what was going on.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there was a colossal failure, I think, on the part of the media, but it also points to a systemic weakness, Claire, in American politics. And that is, because Joe Biden has been around for so long, there are very, very many people within the party infrastructure and in the donor circle whose lives and livelihoods really depended on Joe Biden. Joe Biden got them to the top of the mountain. And similarly, from their point of view, they were determined that he would continue on. And effectively, there were lots of Democrats, and I've spoken to people who worked for them, who were sniffing around saying, we think that Biden's not up to this. We want to take him on in the primary. But they were effectively boxed out of the process because of very, very powerful interests at the top, again, who owe their careers to Joe Biden, who helped stymie any challenge. I mean, for instance, one of the things is Joe Biden lost badly in both Iowa and New Hampshire in 2020. He was really struggling. And what did the Democratic National Committee do ahead of 2024, knowing that Biden was vulnerable to a primary challenge? They decided that Iowa and New Hampshire didn't count anymore. So again, the process, you can argue, was effectively rigged in favor of Joe Biden.
Mm-hmm. Now, Sarah, as if to underscore the frantic nature of the U.S. presidency, there are multiple global crises on the president's desk today, including this phone call with the Russian President Vladimir Putin, which we were told in the last little while is due to happen at 3 p.m. our time. What is the expectation from that call?
Yes, so President Trump announcing in a social media post that he'd be having that phone call with Russian President Vladimir Putin at 10 a.m. And that he'd also be speaking with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, as well as various members of NATO, presumably following that call. Now, the call's coming at a time when we've seen, for the first time last week, leaders on a lower level than expected, but from both sides in Ukraine and Russia having their first face-to-face talks in 3 years. And so at one point, it was thought that maybe Zelensky, Putin, and possibly even Trump could have all been at the table. So there is a huge amount of anticipation about this phone call. You've also had President Trump, you know, stepping away from those claims that he could end the conflict in 24 hours. But he did say on that Middle East trip last week that he feels that realistically it will be down to him and the Russian president to have a conversation to lead to any significant breakthrough. While he was speaking to reporters, he said, I don't think anything is going to happen, whether you like it or not, until he and I get together. So the question is this phone conversation them getting together? Will there be, of course, any significant breakthrough? At the same time, you've got NATO members together saying that they've spoken to Trump on Sunday. They're discussing, European leaders, the use of sanctions if Russia fails to engage seriously in peace talks. And there's this push for the US-backed proposal for a 30 day ceasefire. We know Ukraine has basically unequivocally said that they will sign up to that. Russia has delayed. And in the meantime, Claire, the bombing's continuing by Russia on the ground in Ukraine.
Yeah, and we always try to figure out where Trump's head is at, Larry, when it comes to Russia and Ukraine. And we'll remember a number of weeks ago when he seemed to be on the side of Russia. He said something and many people's ears pricked up when he said Vladimir Putin needs this war to end. Only he and I know why. What tack are you expecting Donald Trump to take? What attitude are you expecting him to take to Vladimir Putin in that phone call today?
Well, I've learned not to try to predict anything that Donald Trump is going to do or say.
Wise.
What I think we can say for sure is that Donald Trump is very frustrated with Putin and frustrated with this situation. I don't think it's out of any humanitarian basis. I think it is on the premise that he said to the American people, I will solve this in 24 hours. This never would have happened if I was president. And he's frustrated that he hasn't been able to end this thing. I don't think he has a particular horse in the fight, nor do I think he really cares much about Ukraine. But I think he wants to get this thing done, and he perceives Putin to have the cards, as he has said on numerous occasions. Now, the question becomes, what tack is he going to take on the phone today? And one could hope that he will take a strong tack, that he will say, sanctions, that he will talk perhaps about re-upping aid to Ukraine. That's what we can hope for. But what will he do? I just don't know, because the precedent has been that he backs down. And I think that Putin will have no reason but to be absolutely robust, because I think he'll look at what happened recently with China, when China fought back and said, you want a trade war? We'll fight a trade war. Mm-hmm. And Donald Trump backed down very quickly. So Putin really has no reason other than to go in with a hard line.
Sarah, we've heard from Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister as well today, saying he is going to allow limited aid into Gaza for diplomatic reasons, as he put it, but also from the Israeli army, who have told people in Gaza to move to the south as the military operation intensifies there. Are there signs, do you believe, that the relationship between Donald Trump and Netanyahu, that relationship is fraying?
I think it is fair to say that certainly there are signs. President Trump has bypassed Israel at least twice this month. You had the release of the Israeli-American hostage that was negotiated by the US and Hamas without Israel's involvement. And you also had, of course, on the Middle East tour and President Trump's first major foreign trip, Israel wasn't on that list. So it's a time when the eyes of the world, are on what is happening on the ground. Since Thursday, more than 300 people are thought to have been killed in Gaza by these more intense Israeli airstrikes and the launching of this grand operation in Gaza on Sunday. The Palestinian Ministry of Health saying entire families have been killed while sleeping together, and just consistent repeated warnings from those on the ground, both aid workers, journalists, saying about the harrowing situation that is playing out there, impacting civilians. The estimates are now that more than 53,000 people have been killed in Gaza, and the majority of them, again, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry, are women and children. So 53,000 people. And the news that Israel is going to allow what they have called a basic amount of humanitarian aid and food into the country, that comes on the back of these very, very serious warnings about the risk of starvation, that's according to the UN, facing the entire population. And Claire, we had that very stark moment where the UN relief chief last week, he sort of faced down the Security Council and saying, Israel is using starvation as a bargaining chip, mm-hmm. that was his words, and urging the Security Council to act decisively to prevent genocide in Gaza.
Okay, well, we leave it there for now. Sarah Firth in Washington and Larry Donnelly, thank you both for joining us.